We have two very distinguished speakers with us today. The first speaker is Achin Vanai. He's an independent scholar and a journalist. He is professor of international relations and global politics at Delhi University, and he is the author of several books, including The Furies of Indian Communalism. His forthcoming edited book is called Selling US Wars. And contributors to that book are Susan George, Tariq Ali, and Walden Bell. Can you please welcome Achin Vanai?
Thank you very much, Taloch and friends. I'm very happy to be here. The topic is political terrorism and the U.S. imperial project. And of course, what I'm referring to when I'm talking about the U.S. imperial project is the post-Cold War project. And I want to start with 9/11. I was 2 hours away from landing at Washington, happened, and our plane was diverted to Montreal. And certain things struck me, because although it took us a day to get back, get into the United States, they closed the borders between Canada and the United States on television and so on. We got a sense, one very important thing was that ordinary Americans asked themselves a very, very important question. And that question was, why do they hate us? And what is meant by that notion of they is not just the perpetrators, but, you know, the larger group of people who might have supported it, or even those who, while condemning it, could have a sense of understanding what it was. And this is a very, very important question, because the answer to it is very simple when you talk about that larger they. And that's because they hate U.S. foreign policy. It's as simple as that. But the American establishment had to divert attention from this obvious answer, and therefore talk in terms of, you know, they hate us because they hate our values, they hate democracy, this, that, etc. And they, by and large, in my view, have succeeded to that to a very considerable extent. The other thing that I noticed, of course, in that context there, was that within 24 hours of 9/11, the United States government came out with three crucial statements. First, they said, we are about to launch a global war on terrorism. Second, this is going to take 8 to 10 years. Subsequently, of course, they're talking about decades. And third, an extremely important statement, we are not going to make any distinction between the terrorist perpetrators and the countries that host them. The first statement, global war, the terms global and war are not at all coincidental. By declaring, if you like, a global war on terrorism, what they were basically saying is that this is a war, and in a war, of course, you don't wait for the other side to hit you again. This is not to be understood as some kind of international crime against humanity. This is to be understood as the first salvo in a war. And we, the United States, must now operate as such, and that means that we can preempt, we can attack anything, anywhere. And since it's a global war, of course, we have to be prepared to do it anywhere. 8 to 10 years, increasingly, in fact, even longer. In effect, they were giving themselves, if you like, the justification, the carte blanche for saying that we are prepared and we must be prepared and we will attack anywhere we think necessary, with any means for us, as long as we like, and so on. The third statement is particularly important. If you do not distinguish between the countries that host terrorists and the terrorist perpetrators, then morally and politically you're doing two things. Morally, of course, you're just acting in terms of an opposition to elementary principles of morality and justice, because there are always circles, degrees, levels of responsibility, and you have to make distinctions between the two. I've given this example before, but this seems to be a very obvious example. You don't treat the orderly who's ushering in the victims in a concentration camp into the gas chambers in the same way that you're going to hold or punish the commandant. You don't attack or hold, criminally speaking, punish the social welfare department or even the Nazi government in the same way that you're going to punish those people who are responsible for the concentration camps and so on. There are always levels of responsibility. Person who houses the murderer is not to be treated the same as the murderer himself or herself. That's obvious. Politically, strategically, what the United States of America did by this statement was very, very important. It immediately translated a conflict between the United States and a non-state network, Al-Qaeda, into a conflict between the United States and other states. And this is something that is very, very important for the United States because it immediately utilized this global war on terrorism as a crucial discourse of justification for its larger imperial project, which of course requires it to treat ruthlessly what it considers to be recalcitrant states or whatever. Therefore, this translation upwards immediately gave it a basis and a justification for doing whatever it liked and fits into that. And this global war on terrorism, this discourse, ideological discourse which has emerged, is to my mind one of the most important dangers and one of the most important aspects of what we can call the software of the US imperial project. The hardware, if you like, is related to its military bases, 730 plus in 135 countries, much more than at the peak of the Cold War. Part of its hardware, of course, is its regional alliances that it must build with all kinds of countries from Japan, India, and so on. But the software is particularly important because we live in times in which the element of consent, the organization of consent, is absolutely central. This is something I want to come back to when I talk at a little more length about the global war on terrorism. But let me now come to begin with, if you like, on this question of what do we understand by international political terrorism. And here we have a serious problem in that it is virtually impossible to arrive at a universally acceptable definition of this concept. The problem is not the term international, very easy, citizens of two or more countries are involved. The problem is not the notion of the political aspect or dimension of terrorism, very simple, it's that terrorist act or acts which are related to some political cause for some political purpose and so on. The problem is the term terrorism. And terrorism is connected to two other concepts, the concept of intimidation and the concept of violence. And since both of these terms are themselves susceptible, if you like, to a range of understandings, broader or narrower, it means that your attempt to understand or define terrorism can take a broader or narrower focus. It's very focused, it's very, very tricky, very difficult. I don't want to spell out the difficulties because I don't want to go on too much length about this, but there are various criteria that you will have to decide for yourself in terms of what you're going to side with, in terms of arriving at your understanding of this notion. What are some of those criteria? Should we treat political terrorism as an ancient phenomenon or a modern phenomenon? Without going into too much detail, I prefer to treat it as a modern phenomenon because I think that modern politics is profoundly different from the politics of the past, and therefore terrorism in the modern era, of course, is profoundly different in its political impact, and I prefer to do that. But there's no hard and fast rule. You can define it in a way in which you would say it's something ancient as well. But I prefer that. And if you're talking about modern political terrorism, then there's been an historical variability of the forms that it takes. It was first, the first term first emerges in the context of the French Revolution, the Great Terror. State terror was what it was referring to. In the late 19th century, it's referring to the Narodniks, those who were carrying out the politics of assassination. Later on, in the second third of the 20th century, it's being referred to people who are carrying out national liberation struggles, EOKA in Cyprus, the Bengal revolutionaries, Kenyan Mau Mau, any number. And then, of course, more recently, of course, is being used to refer to Islamic terrorists and so on. And, of course, throughout this whole history, states have been involved in terrorist activity. You also have a problem in whether you're going to attempt to have a definition which includes terrorist acts, terrorist campaigns, and terrorist regimes. My own preference is that we concentrate on terrorist acts and campaigns. Campaigns, if you like, are a series of acts which are joined by some tactic or strategy, overarching tactic or strategy, and leave out trying to have a definition which will also encompass terrorist regimes. But that's my point of view. What are some of the other criteria? Is it to be understood as something that is by its very nature and definition pejorative, or do you have to have a neutral definition? Because could there be cases of terrorism that we are prepared to ethically justify? And this might surprise you, but I would say to you that there are certain cases, especially when you recognize that terrorism also refers to political assassination. And there are many examples that I can give you, but the most obvious example is, in fact, if you look at your history books, the 1944 officers' plot against Hitler was referred to as a terrorist act. But that's not a terrorist act that we necessarily have to be opposed to. Similarly, if there's an attempt to assassinate by a Vietnamese, an American president, and the Vietnamese do not necessarily have to believe that this is something that is wrong, and various ways. But That's one dimension. Another dimension which is very important is whether you need to have a broad or narrow definition of violence. And my preference here is to have a narrow definition of violence. That is to say something that relates to the use of, or the threat, or the actual carrying out of violence which would involve the physical injury to persons, not to property, even the threat, but narrow. Because you can have a very broad definition of violence. Poverty is violence, and therefore the terrorism of poverty and so on. The other criteria which is very important is, are you going to have an objective or subjective definition? One that relates to the motivations of the terrorist perpetrators. And there are a number of people, especially in American academia, Ronald Dworkin and many others, who insist on a subjective definition. That is to say, a definition that says terrorism, political terrorism, is when there is an intent to kill civilians, which of course leaves a loophole, which means that the United States government can get away by saying, well, what we're doing is not terrorism because we don't intend to kill civilians. But the United States government carries out acts that it knows are going to kill civilians. And for me, the philosophical gap between intentionally killing civilians and knowingly killing civilians, I'm afraid, is not so large that I'm prepared to allow those to get away with it, in fact. So I'm in favor, if you like, of an objective definition. We cannot have a fully comprehensive definition, but at least we can have a working definition of political terrorism that will cover a very substantial majority of cases and can be the basis for us to take a position and to decide how we should orient ourselves to this particular problem. And here my criteria would be modern, objective, ethically pejorative, of course violence in the narrow sense. That's definitionally seen as pejorative. And there would be something along the lines of those acts, I'm talking about acts and campaigns, I'm not talking about regimes. Acts which involve, if you like, a threat or the actual carrying out of violence against innocent civilians. Something along those lines could satisfy a broad range of categories here. And I want to come to something which is very, very important, and that is the sole issue of state terrorism and terrorism carried out by states and those carried out by individuals or groups. Terrorism is a means of political violence, and therefore it can be carried out by a variety of agents. What is the difference between the terrorism that is carried out by states and that which is carried out by non-state actors? And I want to suggest to you three crucial differences. Again, there are differences, but you will have exceptions on both sides. But again, they provide us some kind of a framework for understanding the phenomenon. What are these differences? First of all, there is the question that when you're talking about non-state terrorism, it's two-directional. Marxists have used the term that, and anarchists have said that terrorism of the non-state type is the propaganda of the deed. It's also referred to sometimes as reformism of the gun. That is to say, Marxists believe in a dramatic change in terms of social upheaval, and they use this term in the context of individual assassinations and the futility of the idea that you can transform the system by killing off a few people, etc. And therefore they call it, it's like reformism with the gun. You think you can actually make a change in this particular way rather than the more systematic revolutionary changes that are required. But propaganda of the deed. The meaning of this is very simple. It's essentially the symbolic aspect of non-state terrorism that is so important, which is why it tends to be, it is in most cases of non-state terrorism acknowledged. There are exceptions, but it's acknowledged. The purpose of the thing, of the act, is symbolic. And it's to send a message in two directions, to your opponents and to the constituency of your opposing government or whatever. And it's also meant to send a message to your home constituency. The message to your opponents is that we are going to carry on struggle. The message to your own consistency, we'll never give up, keep the morale up, we're going to carry on fighting. When you're talking about state terrorism, for the most part, it is one direction. It is to drive home the message to your opponents, don't mess with us. Your struggle is futile. We're going to fix you. That's the kind of message. They don't want to send a message back, which is why they don't like it, if you like, in India, if civil liberties groups point out that the Indian government has been carrying out terrorist actions and violations of civil rights, of hurting civilians in Kashmir or the Northeast, etc. You're anti-patriotic, what are you doing, and so on. The United States government doesn't like Abu Ghraib coming out, comes out in a particular context, of course, and so on. So it's one direction. However, you can have occasions where the state is now so brazen and so comfortable in its brazenness because its constituency is now so morally desensitized that it can be blatant and open about it, doesn't care. And the classic example of this today is that country or that government, Israel. A morally desensitized population which is prepared in so many ways to accept and rationalize what the Israelis do. And this is wonderful for the Israeli government, or even for the United States government. They don't even have to try and hide it. But by and large, that's one crucial difference. The two-directionality, one-directionality. The second difference is the question of scale. The scale of terrorism by states is incredibly huge compared to that of non-state terrorism. Before 9/11, you can't even think of a particular act which involved the killing of 100 people or more. Much, much less. Try and think of any act before 9/11 by non-state terrorists that even involved 100 plus people being killed. In the case of course, terrorism by states, what can I say? The United States government has killed innocent civilians outside of its borders in the millions, from Korea to into China to other places. Today I was reading in the paper, 650,000 Iraqi casualties. 3,000 people killed in 9/11. At least 10,000 Afghan civilians, not soldiers killed in Afghanistan after that. Bush talks about 30,000, we have here 650,000. Why this great difference in scale? And the reason does not have to do primarily with the fact that states have much greater means than non-state actors. Obviously they do. It has much more to do with the grandiose character of the ends that states posit for themselves. And when they do what they say, we're doing it in the name of national security, we're doing it in the name of national interest, we're doing it in the name of fighting communism, we're doing it in the name of fighting imperialism, we're doing it in the name of exporting democracy, and so on. When a non-state actors do it, even if the end is a large end like national liberation, it's usually done for a specific purpose, release of political prisoners and so on, and therefore there's always a certain proportionality in terms of that. Because you can't, the terrorism of the weak, if you like, knows that it cannot defeat the other side militarily. That's not the purpose of the terrorist act, generally speaking. Again, there are exceptions. Even 9/11, where the scale of non-state terrorism was so large, I would suggest to you, was because the ends that were being pursued by Al-Qaeda were also very large and grandiose. And that was, we're going to teach a lesson to the Satan, the larger enemy Satan, and their home constituency is not a specific people like, say, the Palestinians or whatever, but a much larger constituency like this is, of course, the Muslim world or whatever that is being opposed by the Satan, and we have to oppose that. But the scale is much larger. And this obviously indicates to us that if we're serious about trying to tackle this problem of terrorism, we have to recognize that state terrorism is our biggest problem, the terrorism of states. But the discourse on terrorism everywhere today is dominated by the discourse that it's the non-state actors that are such a big problem. Frankly speaking, the terrorism of the weak is not such a big problem as the terrorism of the states. Even when you take your London bombings or your Madrid bombings or the bombings of the trains in Bombay, etc., and you have the Indian government and the media saying, oh, this is going to shake Indian society, this is bunkum. This is an expression in many ways of despair. The sturdiness of the political structures and the capitalist structures in the United States are not, in Britain, are not going to be shaken by the London bombings. In India, we had in 2002, Gujarat, a pogrom that was carried out by Narendra Modi, by the state, in terms of about 150,000 Muslims displaced and so on. The terrorism of Israel, in which 1,400 people plus are killed, in which thousands are being wounded, in which close to 1 million people are displaced, billions of dollars worth of damage. That is much more devastating than, of course, the terrorism of non-state actors. So that's your second difference. The third difference, which is important and which gives, if you like, sustenance to the hype about the terrible danger of non-state terrorism, is that non-state terrorism tends to seems much more random in character. When you're talking about the terrorism of states, it's far away. It's there in Iraq, it's there in Afghanistan. It doesn't have to affect us in Scotland or England or whatever. It's there in the northeast of India and in Kashmir. But the terrorism of the non-state actor blowing up trains here, it seems as if it could affect us in some ways, our friends and everyone. There's a sense of randomness about it that seems to create a greater fear. Of course, even this non-state terrorism is not entirely random. It takes place in London and Madrid. It doesn't take place in Sweden because Sweden wasn't an ally of the United States. with regard to Iraq. We have to keep in mind this whole question of state terrorism and the centrality, but despite the kind of discourse that surrounds the preoccupation with non-state terrorism, we're fighting that here. And this brings us, if you like, to this question of ideology. When Rumsfeld said terrorism is terrorism and all this is nonsense. But terrorism must not be seen as an ideology. It is a means of political violence and therefore can be used by all kinds of agents. But although terrorism is not an ideology, terrorism always comes with some ideology. Because it is that ideology which inspires it or justifies it or does both. But when it comes with an ideology, you can also oppose it in the name of that very ideology. It is being done in the name of Islam, it can be opposed in the name of Islam. It does in the name of Christianity, in the name of some kind of secular discourse, in the name of national security, and you can also turn around and say, this is not the way that we should pursue our national security, national agenda. You don't have to be a leftist to say that also, either. Right? You can always oppose in that in the name. This is not the way to promote democracy, even though I think the United States and Britain governments are great countries and blah, 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 the usual stuff. You can still oppose it in the name of that kind of ideology. But what happens when the United States of America says we're going to launch a global war on terrorism? What they're doing then is that they're militarizing the solution to this problem. And when you attempt to militarize the solution to the problem, then what you're going to do is that you're going to promote one means or one kind of political violence to try in the name of trying to counter another kind of political violence, which means that you're going to promote another kind of terrorism in the name of fighting another one. And that's exactly what the United States has done in Afghanistan and, of course, in Iraq. More important than this, from my point of view, is that this global war on terrorism is one of the crucial discourses that the United States is now using to promote its imperial project. During the Cold War period, there was one overarching discourse which was centrally important to it, and that was defending the free world against the communist threat. And notice how it said defending the free world. And notice nowadays that it doesn't talk about defending, because now that the Soviet Union is no longer there, it has to be more aggressive. It talks about promoting democracy. There's about defending democracy. Now it has to be more aggressive, it has to be different. But that was your overarching discourse. Now, after the end of the Cold War, in my view, and this is of course what our forthcoming book is substantially about with some prefatory chapters, and that is that there are six discourses that are now being used by the United States of America. They predated in their historical emergence, but their significance, of course, has become greater after the post-World War, and the United States government shifts between these discourses. What are these discourses? Can shift and utilizes for different contexts, different audiences, different times, different geographical contexts, and so on. The global war on terrorism. Weapons of mass destruction in the wrong hand. Humanitarian intervention in the name of democracy. Regime change in the name of democracy, different from the third, because humanitarian intervention means when the crisis is over, you're supposed to pull out. But if you're going to change the regime, it rationalizes occupation, right, to a longer term project. Fifth, failed states. Sixth, the war on drugs. Of these, interesting enough, only one of them, if you like, in the name of democracy, has the positive content which gives it certain advantages. Nonetheless, I would suggest to you that the global war on terrorism is particularly effective. These discourses have to apply to basically three population zones for the United States. One is the domestic population. Second, the population of the targeted area, West Asia, which you refer to as the Middle East. Yeah, that's one. And third, the governments and elites, middle classes, and hopefully larger masses in your other countries, whether allies, neutrals, or whatever, Britain, Europe, India, China, and so on. Here, the global war on terrorism has certain advantages for the domestic population of the United States, even as it has for others. And to understand the impact that it has on the United States of America, American political culture is constructed in such a way that the discourse that it adopts has two characteristics. It's messianic and it is paranoid, which is why you have the advantage of why you have this discourse which seems so cruel to Europeans about the evil empire, the axis of evil, and so on. I won't go on to ask why it is, but this is important, and you'll notice that the global war on terrorism feeds into the messianic and the paranoid aspect of American political culture. Its advantages, longevity. 50 years, 60 years, you can do it now that the Cold War is over. Second advantage, geographical scope. Third advantage, it addresses a real felt problem within the United States public. Fourth advantage, vested interests that emerged in the Cold War context can now latch on to this and justify themselves here. Fifth advantage, indirectly, it helps the squeezing politically and ideologically of democracy and so on, which is part and parcel of the neoliberal project. And the sixth advantage is that it can connect to that other discourse of weapons of mass destruction through the notion of nuclear terrorism. I would also suggest to you that, in fact, another corollary or connection with this ideology of global war on terrorism is the demonization of Islam and Muslims, which is, of course, taking place. This is double-edged. The American government needs Muslim client regimes. It doesn't help them to talk to demonize Islam, so you have a division of labor. Bush can sometimes talk about, oh, how great Islam is, and we are actually fighting for true Islam against these people who are betraying it and so on. But leave it to civil society organizations, academia and the media to push this business of, well, Muslims are. And this reflects itself in various forms of the language we use. A common example that I've used, but which is important, is there's no such thing as Islamic terrorism. Have you ever heard of Christianic terrorism, Buddhistic terrorism, Hinduistic terrorism? You have heard of Hindu terrorists and Muslim terrorists and Sikh terrorists and secular terrorists of all kinds, etc. But using a term like Islamic terrorism is to connect a religion to that, which you don't do in the case of others, but of course you're doing that in the case of Islam. And there's so many other examples that one can also give here. Why this demonization of Islam? And I think in an historical context, it's important to understand that relative to other parts of the world, the Islamic part of the world provided stronger resistance to imperial powers historically for a variety of reasons, existence of the Ottoman Empire, what happens after the First World War, and so on. If you like, there has been, even after the Second World War, what I would say is a historical consistency of opposition to imperial powers, say in West Asia and Central Asia. But there has been ideological variability of the leadership of those resistance, from the radical nationalists, leftists, and so on, now to more political Islamists. Forces of various kinds. But that is a rationalization for why it's important for the United States, because if it wants to establish its informal project, global project, it has to control West Asia and Central Asia. Not just for the question of oil, but also because geopolitically it's the pivot of the whole imperial project. And if you want to understand the imperial project of the United States, then please do not listen to lefties. Listen to what the right says in the United States of America. Because what I like about the right in the United States of America is not even wishy-washy liberalism stuff. They lay it out clearly. Listen to them. See what they're saying. And they make it absolutely clear what they're up to in that sense here. And of course, they have to dominate Asia. Charles Ahmed yesterday pointed out very well the centrality of different parts of Asia as part of this larger imperial project of the United States of America. Yeah. And now, I have good news for you. I'll be finishing very soon. What do we do? How do we address this problem? We have two responsibilities. One, fighting empire. And this is absolutely central. And we have to politically defeat it. And we can politically defeat it. Because what is political struggle ultimately all about? Political struggle is not, above all, a contest of arms. It's not, above all, a contest of economic strength. It is a contest of wills, in which one side seeks to impose its will on the other side. But what happens when the side that is weaker economically and politically says nothing doing? Our will is so wide and so deep that you will never succeed in imposing itself on us. That's what was meant by the Vietnamese struggle. That's why the Vietnamese can win politically, where you can have decolonization, the end of apartheid. And what, to me, progressive politics is all about, a very large part of what progressive politics is all about, is, if you like, initiating, strengthening, deepening, expanding, expressing that will to resist in a myriad forms, culturally, to what we write, to what we speak, to the poetry, music, whatever. That's what progressive politics is about, in a certain sense. And in the longer sense, of course, we can win. So we have a responsibility to fight the American Empire. Apart from that, to address this problem of political terrorism in a universal and impartial manner. And here I would suggest that this has to be done at three levels. It has to be done morally, politically, and emotionally. What I meant morally is very simple: no double standards. you oppose the suicide bombing that kills the innocent Israeli child and woman or elderly person. That's different from attacking Israeli soldiers or even armed settlers. But you have to, of course, oppose the even more horrendous brutality of the Israeli government and so on. Politically, it's utterly counterproductive if you're just going to pretend that terrorism is the terrorism of the weak and not address the question of the terrorism of the strong, because those who are suffering injustices and they see that the terrorism of the strong can get away, etc., are going to continue to fight in various ways, and of course that creates. Emotionally, it's very important to be universalist. In the face of the Holocaust, in the face of 9/11, many Americans and many Jews, of course, have said never again. And this is a sentiment that must be respected. But you can say never again to my people, or you can say never again to any people. And unfortunately, too many Jews and too many Americans say never again, and too many Indians say never again to my people. And what happens then is that you build that emotional reservoir for these governments to manipulate that sentiment, of course, to do other things here. And lastly, of course, three suggestions as to what we have to do. One, of course, it's a long-term struggle. We can diminish, but we're not going to end it. But we can greatly diminish this problem of political terrorism, but we have to address the political context in which it takes place and fight for just solutions. You can't escape this. It's a question of addressing the question of Israel, Palestine, Chechnya, and other places, Kashmir, and so on. And we must push for international and national laws that are much more progressive. For example, the Pinochet affair, the Belgian example before it got reversed, and institutionally, internationally, international laws. And I would even suggest that for all its weaknesses, the International Criminal Court was a step forward. And let me just end by pointing out of the few countries that refuse to be part of the International Criminal Court, I'll just mention four. First, the United States of America, absolutely no surprise to you, I'm sure. Israel, again, I'm sure no surprise to you. China, and the fourth country, which should also not be a surprise to you, India. Thank you very much.